Chicago's afternoon news here on 720 WGN. It's 5:39 on this Friday afternoon. Hope you're having a great day. John Hanson in for Steve Bertrand till 7. I'll be with you next week, too, all week long for Chicago's afternoon news. Here on October 8th, the sun sets around 6:19 in Chicago. That's the same every year. It's set at 6:19 p.m. on the night of October 8th, 1871 as well. The temperatures that day reached into the mid-80s. That's important to the story I'm about to tell you. And about 2 miles from where I sit right now, we're a 303 East Wacker. If there were no tall buildings, I might even be able to see it from here. At West Decoven Street, if you don't know where that is, it's just off the Dan Ryan Expressway at Taylor. Or if you ever take the train lines into the city right before the metro lines from the south or southwest suburbs head underground, just to the west of there stood Miss O'Leary Barn. Right now, quite ironically, the Chicago Fire Department Academy is right there. And it was an eventful night 150 years ago. And of course, a lot of mystery has surrounded what happened that night. And Dick Bales is someone who's really looked into it. In fact, wrote the book about it, The Great Chicago Fire and the Myth of Mrs. O'Leary's Cow. Dick, thanks for joining us here today.
Oh, thank you, John. I'm glad to be here.
And you did write the book, and I want to know what inspired you to really dig into what happened on that night 150 years ago.
I'd always been interested in the cause of the fire ever since I was in college. I wrote a paper on the fire. Then I started working. I've been in the field of title insurance since 1977. And when I started working for Chicago Title Insurance Company, I knew that the Chicago office still had the pre-fire land records that were kept by abstract companies in 1871. And since I do a lot of work with legal descriptions and work with surveyors, I knew how land was legally described, and so I took advantage of something that no previous fire historian has ever used before, which is these pre-fire land records. I used them to basically map out the old area block as it existed in 1871.
Why is that helpful for breaking down what happened? Why do you need to know where the property lines may be or how big the property was?
Well, it's actually very integral to my research because that's the first part of research. The second part was that the Chicago History Museum had and still has a 4 volumes of a transcript of an investigation held by the Board of Police and Fire Commissioners, an investigation into the cause of the fire and also the conduct of the fire department.
Oh, so we have the first source documents of what happened in that investigation.
Exactly right. It still exists, but they're all handwritten, horrible penmanship. And so I went into the museum every 2 weeks for 2 years straight, got there every other Saturday, worked all Saturday, and transcribed all 1,169 pages of longhand testimony into a notebook computer.
As someone who spent many college weekends, I spent them at the bars in the evening, but I spent them at the looking at microfiche, old newspapers. That sounds so exciting just to hear in the words that they were using. But I imagine it was a lot of hard days too.
Oh, yeah, and especially I did that before the internet. You know, so now as Tribune people know, there's ProQuest, which has a Tribune on computer. I didn't have ProQuest back then. I was going through microfilm, hundreds of microfilm reels looking for information.
I want to know, because I kind of set the stage for what the day was like. We know it was a warm, hot day. We know that contributed to the fire spread. You have seen what the block sort of looked like, at least in what the records are. Describe to us what that block to Coven was like in that day.
It was, I guess the term would hard scrabble would be the good adjective to describe it. It was just a series of shanties, really, all kind of tucked close together. On the O'Leary property had like two homes kind of very close to each other. Her renters, the McLaughlins, lived in front. The O'Leary's lived in back. And the famous barn was in the far back next to an alley. But they're all just very one-story shanties, really. It was near West Side, and Shantyville is what it was.
How many, I mean, it's hard to put into words how many people lived there, but, I mean, they're not as tightly packed in as they are now, right?
No, that is correct, yeah. But there were narrow lots, is what I should say. But there were narrow lots, but they weren't closely packed together, no.
All right. We got to take a quick break, so I don't want you to give away the answer now. But just a yes or no question. Do you think you know how this fire started?
I know who, I am 100% convinced as to who started it. I don't know how we started it.
Well, That's a tease. We're going to find out who started the Great Chicago Fire, at least what Dick Bales thinks, after a quick look at weather and traffic. Mary Vandeveld. Chicago's afternoon news. 150 years ago, about 3 hours from now or so, a fire was started in the barn of Miss O'Leary's house, or in her barn, I should say. For years, we were told that it was the cow, and I think most people know it wasn't. And I guess Dick Bales, who wrote the book about this, are we confident it did start in that barn?
Yes, we are confident that it did start there. It definitely started in the barn.
Is the witness who knows that a suspect in who started it, or is that who you think maybe is the one who started the fire?
Well, I think that one of the witnesses, I think, yes, he did start the fire, yes.
And who is it? And tell us who he is.
His name was, he was a neighbor of the O'Leary's. He lived across the street and kind of kitty corner from the O'Leary home. I know that from our land record search. He has a little plot where he lived in relation to where the O'Leary's lived. And his name was Daniel. His nickname was Pegleg because he had a peg leg. Daniel Pegleg Sullivan. I'm convinced that he started the fire.
Why are you convinced? What do we know in the records that he says about that night?
Well, what he says about that night was after visiting with the O'Leary's, he walked across the street and sat in front of William White's home, which is across the street, and again, even more of a kitty corner from his own home. While sitting there against a fence in front of William White's home, he saw a fire break out in the O'Leary barn. He ran across the street yelling, "Fire, fire, fire," tried to put the fire out, tried to rescue the animals, and then finally banged on the O'Leary's door of their home and tried to warn them of the fire.
And
that is what he testified.
And what do you think he's lying about that?
Oh yes, I do. Yeah, I know he was lying.
What?
For one thing, for example, he testified that he did not know what was on fire when he didn't know what was on fire when he took a statement that was published in the Tribune, but then when he was interviewed during the investigation, he changed his testimony completely and said that the fire was in the lower part of the barn. So there's change of testimony right there. Then there's also lots of circumstantial evidence, most notably by using my map of the O'Leary neighborhood, I was able to see that he couldn't see the fire break out allegedly in the lower part of the barn because the home of James Dalton, the O'Leary's neighbors, would have blocked his view of the barn. He wouldn't be able to see that. Granted, it was a dark night out, and you may argue that the glow of the fire was there, but he said he might have seen the glow of the fire. But again, it was cloudy that night, and the fire was in the lower part of the barn. He really couldn't have seen it. He testified that he couldn't run very fast, but he could yell very loud. That distance, I was able to determine the distance from where he sat to the O'Leary barn was 193 feet. That's more than half the length of a football field. He said he couldn't testify. He said that he could not run very fast. How was he able to get across to Coleman Street, which is raised embankments on either side, past a raised sidewalk, and get to the barn, try to rescue the animals, put the fire out without getting burned himself? James Vidal's wife testified that she was able to escape with her life before her house came crashing down in on her. Doesn't make sense. But most notably, John, think about this, is that for him to do all that he said he did, that fire must have been burning for quite some time. The O'Leary barn was only 45 feet from the O'Leary home. Very hot that night, as you just said. Her windows surely was open because, of course, there was no air conditioning then. The barn door, the barn door was articulated two-door thing. Upper door was open. You know, there's a horse in the barn. You know how horses hate fire with a passion. For the fire had been burning all that long, the horse in the barn would have gone crazy. The bellowing of the horse and the other animals would have warned the O'Leary's long before Mr. Pegleg Sullivan even got to the barn.
Okay, so you're saying that the inconsistent statements, you know, are one suspicious thing, but the fact that he even claims that he saw it when he saw it just isn't possible because you think someone would have seen it first.
Yes.
Okay, so then that leads you to believe that what, he was in the physical barn when it happened?
Oh, yes. I think that he testified that his father kept a cow in the barn, and he'd been in the barn hundreds of times. I think after visiting with the O'Leary's, he walked outside the door, didn't want to go home right away. Maybe he sat in the barn for a little bit. Maybe his leg was hurting him. I don't know. Maybe and while there, he may have smoked a pipe, for example. Maybe dropped a match in the barn. There was hay in the barn at the time. There were wood shavings in the barn because shavings was free fuel to
right.
be for, to be used for that ready for that coming winter. And the fire, he must have started the fire, I think it's purely by accident, and did, John, what any normal person would have done, because it's important to realize there were 28 fires that first week of October. It was very, very dry all that summer. And there's no way of knowing, let me back up, but for a combo of errors, that fire never would have got out of control the way it did. So he had no way of knowing that fire would burn down Chicago. He did what any normal, nice person, good person would have done. He would have tried to put the fire out. He would have tried to, normal, anyone else would have tried to put the fire out, tried to rescue the animals, tried to warn the O'Learys. He did what any normal person would have done under similar circumstances. October 10th, when the fire finally burns out, the early morning of October 10th, he gets out of his home and sees desolation everywhere. He needed an excuse as to say where he was. Sitting in front of William White's home was a perfect excuse. He sat against a fence, which meant that the people on the other side of Coleman Street wouldn't be able to say, "Hey, I was there. I didn't see you sitting there." By testifying, he was kind of far away, but not too close. He had to testify. He was kind of far away in front of William White's home, not too close, because McLaughlin's, the O'Leary's neighbors, had a party going on that night.
So you're basically saying his alibi is just too perfect. It's almost like it was constructed to cover his butt.
You're exactly right. He had a perfect alibi. Perfect alibi.
Interesting. What was his name? I know Pegleg, and I should know his full name. What was it again?
Daniel Sullivan.
Daniel Sullivan. What happened to him afterwards? Do we have any idea?
Don't know. My brother told me one time he was talking to somebody who turns out he said it was a relative, a descendant of Daniel Sullivan. And so I know there's descendants out there in the Chicago area, but I never was able to track him down anything further. He testified, and then as far as I know, he disappeared.
It's fascinating. And so 0 to 100% confidence. Where are you on this?
Yeah. Oh, I'm 100%.
Wow. There's other people that disagree with you, and that's part of historical debate.
Oh, yeah. It's fun.
What do you think? Yeah, right? And that's the thing is that when we solve these mysteries, I know I used to be part of an independent study that tried to figure out who Deep Throat was back in the Nixon days using FBI documents. And that was fun. And we got it wrong, as it turned out. Unfortunately, we probably will never know for sure, but really fascinating stuff. I could ask you many more questions, Dick, but we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Have a great day. Sir. It's the Great Chicago Fire and the Myth of Mrs. O'Leary's Cow. It was written many years ago by Dick Bales, again, who has worked in the Chicago title industry for a while and knows a lot about this stuff. Just a really fascinating read. I want to dig into that a little bit more. By the way, I think we have time for this, Brian. Carl Smith, author of Chicago's Great Fire, The Destruction and Resurrection of an Iconic American City, spoke with WGN-TV earlier this week.
It's a kind of second birth. You know, Chicago as we know it, modern Chicago, basically only 40 years old at the time of the fire, so nothing but a tiny outpost in 1830. And 1871, it's got 330,000 people.
Yeah, it was certainly a rebirth for our city. So we all know the Great Chicago Fire, right? Of course, we grew up in the city or the area. You heard about it anywhere in the country. But did you know there was a fire that burned 2,000 times as much space as the Chicago Fire did and killed 3 to 7 times more people than the Chicago Fire did? It happened on the exact same night as the Chicago Fire, only 250 miles away. We're going to talk about the deadliest fire in American history that happened on the same night as the Great Chicago Fire in a little bit, coming up after this in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. We'll check in with the news after the break here on WGN.
WGN.